and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host tonight, Kate Poppy. Here with me today is Dr. Bill Limpasathian, Professor of Cartography at UW-Madison. Dr. Limpasathian leads the NeuroCarto Lab, which studies cognitive cartography, geospatial cognition, as well as how the brain processes maps. Dr. Limpasathian was the primary cartographer behind the Frank Lloyd Wright Heritage Project, which mapped the locations of the Frank Lloyd Wright architecture in the United States. He previously worked as a cartographer for Apple Maps, the Atlas of Yellowstone, and the Atlas of Wild Migrations, among numerous other projects. Thanks for being here, Dr. Limpasathian.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Could you start out by explaining what cognitive cartography is? Those are two words you don't typically hear together too often.
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Like when you think about a professor of maps, you don't necessarily think about what some of the research I'm interested in. But essentially, it's sort of a newer group of research within geography, cartography, the science and art of map making that sort of looks at the underlying brain process that allows us to use maps. So thinking about maps beyond just a pretty picture or a useful piece of information on the wall or in your high school classrooms or college classroom, but thinking about the cognitive and brain scientific process that underpins that allows us to translate this essentially pretty drawings of our world into actual worlds we can imagine and think about in our heads.
And how did you get interested in studying this?
It's actually very interesting. So when I was doing my master's at Penn State, like forever ago now, in the mid-teens, 20-teens, I was sort of researching some of the perceptual issues in map design. So thinking about the UI UX of what goes into an effective map, how to like design maps that are best for all groups of people. And one of the main trend or one of the main question that kept coming up was how does the psychology side of things, how does the cognitive psychology side of things actually affect this? What is the distinct specialness in how we human perceive our world that affects through this translation layer of what maps are? So I began to jump down that rabbit hole. And next thing you know, I was doing neuroscientific fMRI-based research during my PhD, looking at, okay, what parts of your brain lights up when you do look at maps and try to like figure out and ascertain information from maps.
Yeah, that's very cool. Could you briefly describe what gestalt theory is and the importance of visual contrast in cartography?
Yeah, so Gestalt theory covers a bunch of different things, but specifically as it relates to cartography, Gestalt describes this perceptual grouping process. It was established in the early 1900s when psychology was trying to make sense of what it meant for humans to make sense of our world, essentially. And Gestalt psychologists basically theorize ways that we are able to perceive things that we see and don't see. And one of the biggest things is called perceptual grouping, which is how we relate things to each other. So if you think about even everyday life, like you might see a bunch of objects that have similar shapes next to a bunch of objects that have different shapes. Perceptually, we will want to cognitively link or psychologically link the objects that have similar or the same shape together and exclude the things that are different shape. We can see this in other perceptual issues such as the face versus vase illusion, which sort of captures this need for our brain to try to make sense of things that are similar and different together. So it covers a bunch of different things, but essentially TLDR is that it helps us make sense of a busy world that we see in our daily lives and figure out what is important and what is not.
So is that different from visual contrast?
Visual contrast sort of covers or enables gestalt in a way. So going back to the faces versus vase debate or illusion, we're using the maximal difference in visual contrast to do that. So you can sort of think about visual contrast as simply as light versus dark. That's the basic of lightness or value contrast in one way. Like the more something contrasts with each other, the better we're able to perceive it. So it's one of the more easily studied or identified way to look at gestalt and perceptual grouping.
Could you talk a little bit about aphantasia?
Yeah, so this is sort of my newer line of research that I've been trying to get off the ground since coming here to UW-Madison in 2023. So basically, aphantasia describes this psychological condition where you essentially have a blind mind's eye, where you are unable to visually imagine. Right. So I'm going to give a prompt to you and our readers or listeners, which is one of the classic prompts that is used to talk about this topic. So if I tell everybody to close their eyes and think of an apple, some people will see a very vivid, like, red apple. They can describe the color, they can describe the sheen on the apple, whether there's a leaf, there might be worms on it. People's apples are different. But apparently, research is starting to show that a lot of people see very little details of that imaginary apple, or some people see nothing at all. Essentially, they say they close their eyes and they can think about the concept of an apple. They know what an apple is, but they don't visually see it in their imagination. So that's a very interesting psychological condition, because it counters much of what we expect people to be able to do, right? We can imagine things about ourselves and our world so that we can make decisions from it. And it also relates greatly to how we talk about map cognition, which is how do we read maps? Because maps, again, are just pictures that we have to translate into the world. And what it has historically been understood of is it's part of this larger cognitive cartography issue of creating this mental model in our head. So classically, we think that you see a map and then you begin to imagine that world in our head. But what does it mean if you say you can't imagine that world? Do you still see the same map of the spaces, or do you see something different? So that's sort of why aphantasia really excites me.
Yeah. That's cool. And a lot of people have aphantasia, more than you think, right? What's the number?
Yeah, so the numbers aren't quite definitive yet. More recent research have identified larger and larger numbers of people identifying that that they have aphantasia. I don't actually have a specific number in mind. But one of the funniest thing that led me to stumble on this topic itself was through Twitter, actually. It was like around 2017 or something, and this like imagine an apple practice sort of went viral on Twitter, and people were for the first time realizing that the way one, like, the differences between people's ability to visually imagine. They were saying, oh, I can see a super clear apple versus some people can barely see anything. And the fact that it went viral in the first place sort of cemented or suggested that, oh, this condition that was previously thought of as being nuanced or not that important, it might actually be much more important, and a lot of people might experience this issue. And that sort of like energized a lot of newer research into it, including my own. So,
yeah. It's definitely something that doesn't seem talked about too often, but mm-hmm. everyone experiences it all the time.
Yeah. So. It was interesting when this first came up. I was in a cartography map design laboratory at the University of Oregon, and I was having conversations with my colleagues there. And it turns out, like, at least two of my fellow cartographers identified as aphantasic, and that even threw me farther into a loop, because I was like, not only can you not imagine like a world from the map, but you're also in charge of designing these maps, and they're amazing cartographers and are able to do it. So that sort of highlighted an interesting distinction, that perhaps it's not that they're just unable to do things, but that they're able to utilize other strategies, mental strategies or mental techniques that researchers and people have just not looked at or studied before.
Right. And they're able to describe the features of a scene, right? They just can't specifically imagine it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. One of the theories is that they lean on a more schematic approach to knowledge instead of thinking about things visually, which I would say I do. They are able to conjure up a more like basically lists of facts about something, and from that list of facts you're able to still elicit similar mental representation.
Yeah. It is a continuum too, right? There's not like someone's aphantasia and someone does not have it.
Yes, it's a continuum. Some people identify as hyperphantasic, meaning they have super vivid visual imagination. A lot of people fall somewhere in the middle. Some people identify as having lower or none at all.
So how do you see the future of cartography moving with this in mind? Do you think maps are going to look different, or do you think they'll be mainly the same?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, if we think about the trend of cartography and maps as a whole, it has always evolved with humankind, right? Map making is one of the fundamental human skills. Like, we're the only animal on this planet or that we know that can produce spatial knowledge and communicate with it in a like an indirect way using this media. And we've evolved from cave drawings to maps to navigate the seas to help aid us in exploration, and to this digital smartphone era where most people just rely on the maps on their phone to aid us. And that has come with benefits, but cost in that a lot of people are losing that innate ability to navigate spatially without being dependent on their smartphone. So I would say that maps will continue to evolve along with the needs of humans and technology. But where is it going, or how will it evolve in the future? I can't guess, but hopefully some of the research I'm doing will help guide us into a better direction on that front.
I hope we can switch gears a little bit and get more into a little of the neuroscience behind it. So my next question, what happens in the brain when we're reading a map versus when we're walking around in a city versus simply just imagining a street where you grew up?
Yeah, that's a super great question. In a lot of ways, similar parts of your brain lights up because the brain is sort of general purpose in a lot of ways when it comes to higher cognitive functions. But also there are important nuances between the activities of, in parts of the brains that are responsible for that. Mainly when you look at anything, maps, or your bedroom, or thinking about your childhood, school, or whatnot, your visual cortex will light up. Like if you see something visually, obviously information passed through your eyes and are sent back to actually the back of your head, which is in the occipital lobe where your primary visual cortex is. And in that primary visual cortex, it sort of breaks down all of the constituent parts of a scene, of an image, of a place into the individual things and are sent into higher cognitive function towards the front of your brain along what is called the what, where pathways, the dorsal versus ventral streams. That sort of figures out what is it that you're thinking about or looking at, and where is the different pieces of information fit together and how does it fit together. And through that, eventually, it makes its way to your hippocampus, which is classically known as being very important to memory, but because in a lot of ways, spatial cognition or remembering space is a memory of things. The hippocampus plays a super important role, and that is aided through a lot of functions or activities in your frontal cortex, which is responsible for your executive reasoning. But also there's a very special region, which is the retrosplenial cortex, which is sort of not in the frontal cortex, but that region I'm especially interested in because it's responsible for scene identification. So classifying and figuring out what is in this spatial environment you're looking at and what information can we understand. And obviously, I'm going to add a big caveat to what is important in neuroscience is that a lot of it is dependent on our insights that we get into our brain, but the brain is essentially a big black box. Like, we can do a lot of studies, and a lot of neuroscientists and psychologists do this. Like, we try to show people, our participants, a lot of stimuli while we're scanning their brains, and we see what parts of their brains are lighting up, and we try to make inferences from it. We say, oh, these two parts are lighting up. I want to add a caveat that it's not a one-to-one translation, right? We don't have a direct magnifying glass into what someone's thinking. It's more that we see these patterns and it suggests that we can begin to link together these important parts of our brains to infer important meanings about the human experience.
Cool. So would you say that, obviously with the caveat, that when you're looking at someone who's reading a map versus someone who's thinking about a place, mm-hmm. is it pretty different, or does it all kind of fall under the category of spatial cognition?
Yeah, it's different. A lot of the same regions will activate because a map is spatial, thinking about a place is spatial, but the level of where each part or how much each part lights up or how much each part activates will vary. So if you're thinking about space like mentally and not visually, then obviously regions of your brains that have to do with visual perception won't light up as much because it's not receiving high incoming inbound sensory information. It's being primarily driven by your memory recall versus looking at a map itself, like, adds in that translation layer of like, oh, I'm seeing something and I need to convert this into a mental model. And we can see that even different types of maps will activate, will change this equation of like which part of your brain lights up more. So, yeah.
Yeah. What kind of different maps?
Well, one of the main comparison of map activation that we have looked at, or researchers and my former advisor when I was at the University of Oregon for my PhD have looked at, we looked at the main different types of map, comparing satellite imagery to sort of like the normal typical map you might find on Google Maps, to sort of simplified diagram maps. Think your subway maps or a transit map. Those maps are farther removed from reality, right? They're more simplified to just highlight the general spatial makeup of a subway line. And you can see that there are activity differences as your brain sort of sets forth trying to figure out and translate all these similar pieces of information that have different finite detail or different layers that are in the map. So obviously, satellite imagery is more is a more complicated piece of information. So your brain will ultimately work harder to translate and figure it out versus something that is like your subway map, which is more streamlined to just give you direct information about the specific things. So you can sort of see that performance load, that cognitive load difference through activities in your brain.
Would you say the simpler maps are somewhat easier to understand because, you know, they don't have to sort through all of the extra stuff, or would you say that the extra stuff is beneficial when you're reading a map, even if you don't necessarily get all of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. That sort of goes back to maybe less neuroscientific side, but also it all relates. In cartography, we generally classify maps into two types, reference and thematic maps. So reference maps are general purpose maps. So your Google, your Apple maps that you use on your phone. We primarily use it to figure out where things are and get the general layout. And it's usually very data heavy because it's sort of like we're dumping every piece of information that you might want on a map onto there. And then we have thematic maps, which are thematic, Latin for stuff like theme. So it's more specified or focused on a particular topic that we're interested in. And both types of maps are important, but we can see through research and understanding through psychology and cartography that thematic maps are able to show information that are less in terms of the amount of information, but can show more nuance to that information, which makes it easier for the user to understand through a behavioral approach and as well as on some level the neuropsychology side of things.
Kind of going back to neuroscience, the memory stuff, there are memory mnemonics for placing objects or concepts. I think it's called the memory palace.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you want to remember a series of objects, so you'll put it maybe in your childhood home. You'll put one object in the living room, one in the dining room. And it's a really effective way to remember stuff. So I'm curious, how does this all relate to cartography and neuroscience?
Yeah, you have great questions. One of the things that I was so super blown away a few years ago is I found out that, I forget her name, but the champion of like the remembering the digits of pi person, was sort of using this trick to sort of remember hundreds, if not thousands, of digits for pi, of like imagining like a house and like an environment in order to encode that number information into their mind so that they can aid in recall. And what it basically highlights is sort of that specialness and that uniqueness of our spatial cognitive ability in storing information, right? We often are better at memorizing spatial things than we are just a list of information or a list of numbers. So it sort of unlocks this fundamental human ability, or even mammalian ability, because like we've always navigated space. So this is like understood as one of like the core elementary cognitive function of being alive. So it sort of represents an avenue that is worthy of exploration, because like if you can figure out how to encode more information into space, like you can possibly improve human memory a lot. But yeah,
it's very cool. Kind of related to that, do you think this is affected at all by culture? There's some languages that will have cardinal directions rather than saying left or right, or there's some languages that will say towards the mountain, towards the river. Do you think it's culturally or linguistically related in some way?
Yeah, I definitely think that a lot of our understanding about space and how we think about space is affected by culture and also personal differences. My spatial reasoning abilities is different from you, from our listeners, and we can see it through different cultures of how they experience space. Even how we describe geometry relation is different between languages, or cardinal directions. Like the word for north, south, east, and west sort of changes in references. And we sort of often apply this Western-leaning understanding about space onto the rest of the world. But research or preliminary research has shown that people of different cultures do experience and see space differently because of their upbringing and because of their societal value and because of the differences in language and the building blocks and grammar system of how we talk and think about space itself. So it plays a huge role. And if I had limitless research funding and resources, I would try to capture all the nuances.
Yeah, so really hard. I can imagine there's lots of different maps you could make for lots of cultures.
Yeah, most definitely.
Can people get better at navigation? You mentioned using your phone all the time instead of your memory, and I do feel like that's getting worse for me as well. So what can people get better at it, or is it something that's an innate ability?
Yeah, people can definitely get better at it. I will repeat this often to anyone that will listen, that like your brain is sort of a muscle in that way. Like any skills you practice, mental skills you practice, you'll get better at. So if you are like try to put Google Maps down or Apple Maps down and try to navigate just by yourself, you'll slowly get better at it. You'll begin to register and retain more spatial memory of these places when you're not relying on your phone to tell you to turn left or turn right. But there are also personal differences in that. It sort of touches on this idea in psychology called a navigational perspective or reference frames. A lot of people have their default of how they like to navigate, or their preferred way method of navigation, an allocentric versus egocentric navigational perspective. Egocentric meaning the self. So imagine you're going to the store and you tell yourself that, oh, I need to walk until the CVS and turn right, and then that will lead me to the grocery store. That's sort of the egocentric perspective of how you imagine about think about space through how different things in space relate to you. And then there are a lot of people that will prefer a more allocentric approach, which is that they build up this mental model of spaces in their mind. They can think about, instead of thinking about how the store relates to themselves, they think about how the store relates to other places that surrounds it, and sort of can visualize or mentalize this almost bird's eye view map of their surrounding. And Most people, everyone can use both, but most people will identify as preferring one method over the other. But it is very much possible to train yourself and get better at it. Research have shown that if you hike more, you'll sort of begin to be able to better, you'll get better at allocentrically navigating. And that just is part of it. Yeah. So, yes.
So is that because they're going places they've never been before, so they're kind of forced to trust their instincts in a way, versus egocentric might be they're going to a familiar place that they've been before and they're remembering how to get there?
Yep. That's an important link, that egocentric navigation is linked to sort of a more purposeful or like a more repeat navigation route. But yeah, so allocentric is sort of like using this sense of like, oh, I sort of know what general item or destination is, and sort of figuring out, relying on our spatial like problem solving skills to sort of help us aid us in our navigation. So yes, it is leaning more on that. And the more you do it, the better you are at solving these spatial problems.
So you mentioned this briefly before, but what kind of research are you focused on now that you're here at UW-Madison?
Yeah, so I mentioned aphantasic research project. I literally just submitted a research proposal this past week on it, hopefully to get some good funding so that I can do some more exploration on that topic. But that is my highest priority right now, sort of understanding, okay, taking what we know about map cognition beforehand, or what we have known about map cognition, which sort of assumes that there's this baseline human understanding of how we read and understand maps, and sort of applying this aphantasic lens into it to sort of highlight that, no, there isn't a universal experience for how we read and navigate space, that it's very nuanced, and that there are a lot of neurodiverse groups that experience spaces differently. And using aphantasic, the aphantasic group as the key principal example of like, oh, these are a group of people that are also able to cognize, navigate, understand space, reads maps, but are doing so in a way that doesn't fit with how we've previously understood map reading and spatial cognition. Does this mean that we've been studying this sort of topic wrong? Do we have to expand our understanding, which is my take on it? So using sort of these conditions and using this theme to expand our existing knowledge of spatial reasoning and map cognition is my main line of research going forward.
Well, you have some very cool research. I was looking it up a little bit earlier.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts? Anything you want to add that people should know?
I guess, I don't know, navigate, get out there, put down your phone and just walk around your city, get to know your places. And yeah, thank you so much for having me also. Like you had
so much
amazing
for being
questions.
Here. Yeah. Thank you. And that was Dr. Bill Limpasathian, professor of cartography at UW-Madison. You're listening to It's Professional Notion Machine. See you next week and have a great night.